Today, sentiment versus fundamentals. The Property Imperative Weekly to the 11th of January 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's review of the latest from the markets, we look at the gyrations in prices driven by fear, then hope, new economic data as 2020 kicks off, and locally, as the bushfires rage, we consider some of the potential economic consequences for GDP, which is, by the way, a limited measure of anything useful. As usual, we'll start with the global scene, but if you want to jump directly to the Australian section, the time code is shown below. The World Bank published their latest Global Economic Prospects report, and they say that growth in advanced economies is projected to slow to 1.4% this year, below previous projections, in part reflecting lingering weakness in manufacturing, and improve slightly over the rest of the forecast horizon. In contrast, after deaccelerating to an estimated weaker than expected 3.5% last year, growth in emerging countries is projected to increase to 4.1% in 2020, which is 0.5 percentage points below previous forecasts, reflecting downgrades to half of emerging countries, due in part to downward revisions to trade and investment growth. Nonetheless, the recovery in aggregate emerging country growth this year, which assumes continued monetary policy support in many economies, no major swings in commodity prices and generally benign borrowing costs, is not envisioned to be broad-based. About a third of emerging countries are expected to deaccelerate. And they conclude that if the recovery in emerging countries' growth proceeds as expected, per capita growth will remain well below long-term averages and far from sufficient to meet poverty alleviation goals. Now, I have two issues with this. On one hand, weaker growth underscores the fact that economies are being supported by lower interest rates and even quantitative easing, despite the mixed results so far. And more importantly, the quest for perpetual growth is in any case hitting the resource bounds across the planet. I continue to believe we need an alternative path, not wedded to GDP growth, but more balanced to take account of other factors, including quality of life and sustainability. But in all the central institutions, from the World Bank to the IMF, they are still wedded to GDP growth as the success measure. This must change. And they go on to say that against the backdrop of a fragile outlook, the policy challenges confronting the global economy are compounded by subdued productivity growth and high levels of debt. In advanced economies, the weakness of the current expansion has made it difficult for central banks to create room for additional easing. Low global interest rates and the associated reduction in debt service burdens may provide some countries with additional flexibility for the implementation of structural reforms, such as investments in public infrastructure or the adoption of other growth-friendly policies. In addition, governments can create further fiscal space through better tax compliance and enforcement. And that is my second point. Unless we take the window of low-rate opportunity, business as usual will not allow us to transform the economic bases that we need, which is, of course, required for a secure future. And yet, US markets hovered near all-time highs on Friday, as easing Middle East tensions and technology stocks offset concerns about slower-than-expected US jobs growth in December. US jobs increased by 145,000 last month, and that was below the forecast of 164,000, but enough to keep the jobless rate holding near a 50-year low of 3.5%. And yet, average hourly earnings only rose 0.1%, which is lower than expected. Jobs in the construction sector rose 20,000, but the Labour Department pointed out that construction job gains in 2019 were just half of the 2018 level. And remember too that the November job gains of a revised 256,000 reflected a one-time surge as workers from General Motors returned from their strike. So no one should be surprised that December's job gains couldn't match November's gigantic number. Separately, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow told Fox Business Network that the trade deal is on track to be signed on January the 15th. But of course, that's only the phase one trade agreement, which is relatively superficial. The Dow, which had hit 29,000 for the first time, ended down 0.46% at 28,823, but that's up 0.66% across the week and 3.27% across the past month. The S&P 500 closed at 3,265, down 0.29% on the day, but up 0.94% over the week and 3.94% in the past month. The Nasdaq finished at 9,178, down 0.27%, but still up 1.75% over the week and 6.06% over the month. These are big moves. The data did little to change expectations that the Federal Reserve will hold interest rates where they are for most of this year, but the weak wage inflation put pressure on Treasury yields, which led to a slump in financials, mostly banks. The S&P Financials Index closed at 510.52, pretty much flat on the day, but up 0.58% across the week and up 2.69% in the past month. JP Morgan and Citigroup both fell about 1%, while Goldman Sachs ended the day down 0.2% at 242.11, but still up 4.55% over the week and 9.46% in the past month. Falling US Treasury yields weigh on a bank's net interest margin, the difference between the rates they charge on loans and the rates they pay on deposits and borrowings. The 10-year bond ended at 1.82%, which is down 1.98% on the day, though it's still 1.51% higher than a month ago, while the 3-month was at 1.538% and down 0.18% on Friday and down 2.16% over the past month. The benchmark rate on 10-year treasuries has been trending higher since October, suggesting that the sharp slide that unfolded earlier in 2019 has run its course, but the economic outlook is still sufficiently murky to reserve judgment on whether the latest bounce in this key yield is a limited revival after an arguably excessive slide or the start of a sustained rise. If the World Bank's forecasts are reasonable, as I discussed earlier, it follows that the recent rise in the 10-year yield isn't the start of an extended rise. But elsewhere, Apple rose after Credit Suisse became the latest brokerage to raise its price target on the stock, citing better than feared iPhone 11 sales so far. And it closed at 310.33, up 0.23% on the day and up 14.61% over the past month. On the other hand, Boeing fell 1.5% after the company released hundreds of internal messages that contained harshly critical comments on the 737 MAX development. While GE dropped 2.02% on the day to 1167 in a tussle between new tech and old tech. Gold, after reaching a high near 1611 on the Middle East developments, is trading lower, but rallied as the three major US indices hit record highs in early trading and got some support later in the day as bond prices firmed on weaker than expected December payroll growth. That pushed interest rates lower, making non-yielding gold more attractive. So gold was up 18.31% over the past year and settled at 1,563, up 0.55% on Friday. While gold typically takes the opposite route to stocks, since last year, the correlation appears to have changed as investors seek insurance against the possibility of a sudden reversal on Wall Street after a streak of record highs in stocks since the start of the fourth quarter. And oil slipped a little to 59.12, down 0.74%, as fears eased of more bad news from the Middle East. The dollar index, another normally contrarian trade to gold, hit a one-week high of 97.30 on Friday before turning flat at 97.07. After a brief spike, London shares started sliding, led by retailers and banks, still affected by Thursday's weak December sales numbers. The FTSE closed down 0.14% to 7,587, which is still up more than 5% over the past month, while the FT Financials slid 0.5% to 782, but is still up 6.04% over the last month. The pound was flat at 1.306 against the US dollar, as the Bank of England's outgoing Governor Mark Carney's dovish comments and as the latest UK economic indicators published this week are showing that business and retail confidence is on the rise since the December elections, which will go some way towards buffering the remaining uncertainty about UK trade deals and the post-Brexit reality. In Europe, following the better-than-expected German industrial production data, France, Italy and Spain reported relatively good figures, supporting ideas that the troubled sector is stabilising. French industrial output rose 0.3%, a little more than expected. Manufacturing output slipped by 0.1%, but the October series was revised to 0.6% from 0.5%. The benchmark 10-year German bond yield moved just a little to minus 0.238%. but for the week remains up 6 basis points in a strong signal of investors' willingness to pull back from safe haven government debt for riskier assets. On Thursday, China's National Bureau of Statistics reported that consumer prices rose 4.5% in December from a year earlier, while producer prices fell 0.5%. China's Shanghai Composite was down just a little to 3,092. Japanese household spending fell 2% year over year in November. That was a little more than expected, but showed what is likely to be a gradual recovery from the sales increase shock. Spending had collapsed by 5.1% in October. The government's efforts to boost spending do appear to have mitigated the slump compared with the last time the sales tax was hiked back in 2014. Nevertheless, the Japanese economy seems to have contracted sharply in the fourth quarter. And the latest Bloomberg survey showed a median forecast of a 3.7% decline in overall output. Last month, the survey had a median forecast of just 2.6% contraction. And cryptocurrencies did not create investors a festive mood at the end of the year. But with the beginning of the new year, some of them had an opportunity to sell bitcoins at a higher price. And we are seeing the rise in algorithmic trading in the crypto sector. And this means that individual prospective traders are going to be on the back foot ahead. For example, Bitcoin jumped up to 8,400, where it faced severe resistance apart from mistaken news on USDT emission. The geopolitical tension around Iran and the US began to decrease. It became clear that both sides are not interested in further escalation and markets started to return to normal functioning. For Bitcoin, this means a decline. Several well-known traders, however, still hold bullish views on Bitcoin. Forward expectations range from below 5,000 to above 20,000. So, who knows? It closed at 8,059 on Friday, up 9.3% over the week. Hi, it's Liz's interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so, to the local markets. Retail sales for November were higher than expected in seasonally adjusted terms, thanks to the Black Friday sales, but the underlying trends remain weak. As we discussed in our post, retail is still dragging the chain. They rose by 0.9%, twice what economists had expected, and the October series was revised to 0.1% from flat. The November increase was the strongest in 2 years. But the risk is that the Black Friday sales brought forward the holiday purchases, leaving December vulnerable to disappointment. And with household confidence so low, we expect more pain ahead. Already, retail closures are piling up, with Harris Scarf this week announcing 21 store closures across 5 states after recently being placed in receivership, while fashion retailer Bardo also announced the closure of 58 stores with 530 staff to lose jobs, and gaming retailer EB Games has announced the closure of 19 stores with more in trouble. More bricks and mortar retailers will close in 2020 as ongoing consumer weakness converges with the shift to online and digital purchases. And separately, the AIG Service Index fell to 48.7 from 53.7, the weakest since July. The markets continue to lean slightly towards a 25 basis point cut when the Reserve Bank of Australia meets next on the 4th of February. And households remain in strife, according to our mortgage stress analysis. More than 1.1 million households are now registering as being in mortgage stress, despite lower rates for some, thanks to flat or falling incomes and rising costs. The drought and bushfires are putting more pressure on household budgets, so I do not see a circuit breaker. For the details, see our post, Mortgage Stress Shoots Higher in December. While dwelling approvals, which were reported this week, were slightly up, it was mainly due to high rise in New South Wales, and this is a very noisy series. As I discussed in my post, Dwelling Approvals on the Rise, we need to be cautious about this. I'm amazed how the mainstream media cherry-picked the good news and missed the real story. On home prices, the CoreLogic series continues to point to rises across most centres over this last week, Perth apart. And over the trends, I of course remain cautious about this data. And of course, prices are still below their all-time peaks. Of course, I remain cautious about this data, but if you look at the trends in their daily numbers, you will see a decline in the rate of growth of prices since November. This suggests to me again another reason to think property is not going to necessarily bounce higher, but again, averages mask, and we need to look at individual locations to understand the true dynamics. Finally, on the economic impact of the bushfires, the Insurance Council of Australia declared a bushfire catastrophe on the 8th of November, and as at the 10th of January, there have been 10,550 claims lodged with an insured value of $939 million. The council estimates that 1,338 insured homes have been destroyed within the fire region. That figure, though, will go higher. The federal government has designated $2 billion over 2 years to help rebuild bushfire-affected regions. It can also draw down $150 million a year, possibly more, from a $3.9 billion emergency response fund, which was created in the April budget. The New South Wales state government has also allocated $1 billion over 2 years to help rebuild affected areas. Now, we know the Black Saturday fires in Victoria a decade plus ago cost more than $4 billion all up, of which about $1.3 billion were insured losses. The burnt-out area this time is significantly larger, but thankfully the death count is significantly lower, so some lessons have at least been learnt. But then the fires are still burning. Westpac came out with an estimate of around $5 billion for the current event, which is smaller than the impact of the 2010-11 Queensland floods, which had an estimated total cost of $6.4 billion. Bushfires in general tend to incur less damage than other disasters due to the more localised nature of the event. And they estimate a total GDP impact of around 0.2 to 0.5%. AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver estimated the fires will wipe off between 0.25 to 1% of the country's GDP growth in the year, or somewhere between $3 billion and $13 billion. With the economy growing at just 0.4% this year, it's a cost that the Australian economy can't really afford right now. That could take us perilously close to zero or below for a quarter, Oliver told the AFR. And as I discussed in my video, Bushfires, 30 billion and counting, I used the Victorian experience as a baseline and grossed it up by around 6 times to get to an inflation-adjusted 30 billion over 3 years. So far, the fires have charred at least 8.4 million hectares over the whole country, compared with 450,000 hectares affected by Black Saturday. But there are other costs like fading consumer confidence and longer-term effects on health and tourism, as well as agriculture, which are hard to estimate. It's clearly going to dent the GDP, but then the repair activity will enhance the GDP down the track. In fact, these fires are a circuit breaker for the government, who can now park their surplus target and spend whatever it takes to repair the damage. And this will open the gates to fiscal stimulus, which was unheard of just 2 months ago. And that will effectively be a get-out-of-jail card for the government. But the question is, will this be sufficient to turn the economic trajectory around, or will fading consumer confidence still scupper the attempts? Given our reliance on export demand and the price of coal and iron ore, plus government spending, it seems like the RBA will still cut in February to an ever lower cash rate. Meantime, you can watch my show Trade Surprises on the Upside for more on the trade issues. And finally, to local markets. The ASX 100 closed at 5,743.9 on Friday, up 0.82% on the day, and up 2.94% over the week. This is in new high territory. Despite the weak economy, the ASX Financials was up 0.93% to 6,120, still well off the 7,200 range back in 2015. Pretty much all the financial sector stocks were higher this week, apart from AMP, who was down more than 2% across the week, ending at 188. The Aussie-US dollar closed out at 69.01, having been above 70 cents earlier, and it was down 0.73% across the week, though 0.64% higher on Friday, thanks to the influence of the US dollar and the Middle East situation. The Euro-Aussie dollar closed at 1.611, down 0.48% on Friday. The Aussie gold cross closed at 2,263, up 0.02% on Friday, and up 1.35% across the week, while the Aussie Bitcoin cross was at 11,708, up 2.28%, and up 10.49% across the week. Before I go, a quick reminder that on Tuesday, the 21st of January, at 8 p.m. Sydney time, I'll be running my next live Q&A stream. If you have questions for me, you can ask them live via the chat on the night or beforehand via the DFA blog. The links are below. And remember to mark this date in your diary. As normal, we'll update our scenarios and discuss the latest issues surrounding finance and property. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.